Protest demonstrations have been a part of our past and have shaped our local history, of course. Compared to some other urban communities, St. Louis has historically been able to keep the lid on when it comes to the intensity of protests and demonstrations. It may well be because of the area's most famous protest at Jefferson Bank half a century ago. We'll look at it, and at another historic event, one that contributed to the Ferguson of today. Joining me in studio is retired educator and author Dr. John Wright. He has held high administrative positions in the Ferguson, Florissant, Normandy, and St. Louis school districts and is a former member of the U City School Board. He has written extensively about African American history in our region. Dr. Wright, nice to have you with us once again.
Pleasure to be here, Don.
If you would, and if you could, would you put the situation in Ferguson within the context of our local history?
Well, I think after the Shelley versus Kramer decision, which banned racial restriction on housing, we had that came into being was steering. And I think the realtors made a decision early that African Americans would be steered north. And I think that's what happened to Ferguson. And we had three sections of Ferguson. We had the old century-old homes. Then we had a group of homes that were built right after World War II, the small homes. And I think those were the first ones that were targeted.
Yeah, I want to talk in a moment or two a little bit more about Shelley versus Kramer. But, you know, my understanding of the time was, and you've written about this, was that African Americans in St. Louis pretty much were limited to living in an area called the Ville. We know the Ville today. There was no restrictive covenant problem there. Is that correct?
That's correct. But you had a large number living east of Grand, frozen in that area. And then we had another group living in the Ville area. The Ville was only one square mile, so it did not have half the black population, but it had a large number of institutions there that brought a number of professionals to the area.
It was a self-contained community.
You could go from grade school through your professional career in some areas without getting on the bus.
And, of course, Homer Phillips Hospital was located
Homer G. Phillips Hospital, Poro College, Lincoln Law School, were among the many institutions that were there. Nursing school was there also.
Our author, from whom we'll hear in just a moment, said it was an area of an island with invisible fences. What do you think that means?
It was an island surrounded by segregated housing. I know, but you couldn't go below west of Taylor Avenue. They just didn't want you west, and that was one of the things. Cobrian Elementary School was closed for a whole year because we were overcrowded in the Ville. They didn't want African Americans in the area. They didn't have enough whites. So for a year, no African Americans were allowed to go into the school.
The situation that erupted in Ferguson after Michael Brown's death was really historically uncharacteristic, was it not, of reaction to incidents like that in this community?
Well, what happened, I think you have a lot of pent-up feelings. And you never know what sparks are going to ignite the incident. And I think that's what things were happening around the country. And I think Ferguson is a wake-up call to all of us. We just can't keep going as business as usual in some areas without having another explosion.
But we have not experienced, until Ferguson, not experienced the kind of outrage and the tear gas and the rubber bullets and all the rest of it, like some other major cities.
No,
did.
We have not. We haven't had the tanks in the streets. We haven't had armed military. You know, it's interesting. The gear they wore is camouflage, and you're wide open.
Right. It's camouflage for the forest, it looked like, rather than for
urban.
Why St. Louis? Why didn't St. Louis have the kind of uprisings that other communities did?
I'm told that many of the leaders were given jobs. And so when you get in debt with home mortgages, automobile payments, you can't spend time in jail. So leadership decided to provide employment for a number of people.
I want to get to that in a couple of moments because we want to spend considerable time talking about that part of it. That would take us to the Jefferson Bank demonstration. But for some background on Ferguson and how it came into being, as you've just indicated, let's go back to Shelley versus I can't.
Kramer.
Kramer. Shelley versus Curley. We have a Shelley Curley in the building here. I'm sorry for everybody involved. In spite of constitutional protections, blacks were unable to live where they chose, as Dr. Wright has indicated, because of the practice called restrictive covenants, prohibiting blacks from living in certain areas. It took the landmark St. Louis case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1948, almost a century after the 14th Amendment, to fracture the practice of these covenants in St. Louis and elsewhere. It was known as the Shelley versus Kramer case and was detailed by author-historian Jeffrey Copeland, the author of Olivia's Story. J.D. Shelley, a black man, moved his family to St. Louis from Mississippi in 1930. He ran into those restrictive covenants here, and Copeland picks up the story.
When they got to St. Louis, Mr. Shelley and his family could not find property, suitable property to purchase, again, because of the restrictive covenants. So the family had to live down on 9th Street in the city in a terribly run-down tenement house. Through one of the ministers in the Ville area, Mr. Shelley put out the word that he was looking for a place to live. Again, because there were so many people and so few parcels of property that could be purchased, they had to think outside of the box. In this case, outside of the invisible fences of the Ville. So Olivia was brought together with James T. Bush, Margaret Bush Wilson's father, J.D. Shelley, a woman named Josephine Fitzgerald, who turned out to play a very important role in this, we may talk about in a minute.
And she was white.
She was white. Yeah. And then Reverend Danielson. And they came up with a plan that they would try to purchase a piece of property outside the bounds of the Ville where there were restrictive covenants on the property so that they could find a suitable housing for the Shelleys.
The plan was gutsy, and its outcome would shape history.
They met, they decided that what they were going to do would, if they could do it, break down some of those invisible fences. But in order to do it, they had to do it in secret. Again, because what they were doing by the laws of the time were actually illegal. So what they did is they got Mrs. Fitzgerald, who was Caucasian, to step in, and she was part of the conspiracy. She was what was known as a straw buyer. A straw buyer is a term used to describe someone who would purchase a piece of property, who really didn't want that property, and then would transfer the deed to said property to another individual, in this particular case, to Mr. Shelley.
Plotters in the Shelley caper, as Copeland calls it, were a noisy presence in the bank where the title was to be transferred to Shelley by Mrs. Fitzgerald without the clerk noticing. The plan depended on distraction and misdirection.
They had a plan that relied on absolutely precise to the minute timing, certain things that had to happen that day in order for the clerk to do the paperwork that would transfer the title from the straw buyer to the Shelley family. And in doing so, there was so much misdirection, so much confusion that day, that when I heard this described to me by the people who knew about the story, I was alternately howling and had tears rolling down my face because I was so proud of what these individuals had done.
The drama may have seemed less heroic at the time than it does today.
What these five individuals did in coming together without regard for their own personal safety and well-being to provide the framework for what would become the Shelley versus Kramer case was absolutely incredible. And I call them heroes because so many people know about the main players in the fight for civil rights in this country, but what gets lost in the shuffle, especially behind milestone cases like this, is the humanity behind it, the sacrifices that were made by people that were, by every definition of the word, true heroes.
When the Shelleys moved into a home on Labadie, their presence did not sit well with neighbors, especially one Lewis Kramer. He took the Shelley family to court, challenging their ownership because the home was in a restricted covenant neighborhood.
The trial here in St. Louis, actually, the case was brought by Fernand Lewis Kramer to the St. Louis Circuit Court because they didn't feel that it was right for the Shelleys to own the property at 4600 Labadie, which was just catty-corner from where they lived on Labadie Avenue. It showed the best and the worst of times. it showed that at least there was a place legally for these issues to be examined. But even in the courtroom, the way people sat was incredibly segregated. And I talked to eyewitnesses who were there that day in the courtroom, and they said you could have cut the tension with a knife in there.
As a result of what's been called the brilliant work of Shelley's black attorney, George Vaughn, the court ruled for the Shelleys. That was not the end of it, though, but rather the beginning.
The decision, the initial decision, was overturned by the Missouri Supreme Court. And I have listed right here what the Missouri Supreme Court said. It said not all parties in a given area had to sign a restrictive covenant to make it enforceable. Restrictive covenants do not violate the 14th Amendment. When that ruling came down, this was a terrible blow. I had corresponded a lot with Margaret Bush Wilson in the process of writing this book, and I'll never, ever forget one of the letters she sent to me. It said to me that she was having breakfast with her father, James Bush, when the word about the ruling came from the Missouri Supreme Court. At that particular point, he set down his paper, he moved away from the table, and he said, you know what, we're not going to give up this fight. If anything else, now it begins.
The Missouri Supreme Court ruling set the stage for bringing the case before the highest court in the land. In May of 1948, 3 years after the original St. Louis case and decades after restrictive covenants became commonplace in St. Louis, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled.
The Supreme Court actually said, and I think this is kind of funny, they ruled that people can indeed go ahead and make restrictive covenants. They said, that's fine. Go ahead, make as many as you want. However, the courts are not going to support them. So that's how they got around this. That was actually pretty wise.
As a postscript to this story, it should be mentioned that a key player in the Shelley versus Kramer story was White, a woman of principle. It was Josephine Josie Fitzgerald. It was she who took the title to the home at 4600 Labadie and then turned it over to J.D. Shelley. She paid a price.
A wonderful woman turned into something of a social pariah for many people in St. Louis because she did help with this conspiracy. Many people felt that what was done was absolutely wrong, legally wrong and morally and ethically wrong, and Josie didn't feel that way. She felt that people are people, and what's most important is a person's soul rather than the color of a skin. Because she was tormented so much after the case, she actually took off, and her whereabouts are still unknown.
Author, historian Jeffrey Copeland, author of Olivia's Story. His comments are part of St. Louis Public Radio's St. Louis History in Black and White project. Includes more than 24 audio histories, many including first-person accounts from those who helped make that history. St. Louis History in Black and White can be found on our website, stlpublicradio.org. Back to Dr. John Wright with us in studio. These people really were heroic. Copeland used that term couple of times.
Oh, yes.
It's a wonderful story of the distraction in the bank. It's almost like the movie The Sting in some regard.
You know, Margaret, according to Bill Clay, whom I spoke with on this, said the NAACP didn't support she and her father when they went to the United States Supreme Court.
Really?
And they had to do that on their own. They missed the mark. They stayed out of that. And so it was a battle fought here in St. Louis with St. Louis individuals.
And it literally and figuratively opened the door, allowing the black population to move from places like the Ville and essentially move north.
Yeah, it changed the housing patterns across America because restricted covenants were just restricted to St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So they played a major role in shaping housing patterns across the USA.
That's Dr. John Wright, and we're talking about the situation in Ferguson over the last couple of weeks and trying to give some historical context to all of that. We'll continue our conversation, and a little bit later we'll talk about the big demonstration here, the one that gets a lot of the attention, if not most of it, and that is the Jefferson Bank demonstration of 1963. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our attempt to put the situation in Ferguson in some historical context here in just a moment. Dr. John Wright, retired educator, author, historian, with me in studio. But before we continue, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. As we've already mentioned, thousands of people have gathered to say goodbye to Michael Brown. They waited this morning in sweltering heat to get into the Friendly Temple Missionary Baptist Church in St. Louis for that funeral. The service is winding down at this hour. More than 11,000 students in Ferguson, Florissant returned to school today after more than a week of missed classes because of Michael Brown's death. Classes in the Ferguson-Florissant School District were scheduled to begin August 14th. 5 days after Michael Brown's shooting death, but street protests, that is, led to several delays. And Illinois Governor Pat Quinn has vetoed two related bills that would have placed statewide rules on the unregulated industry that connects passengers and drivers through a smartphone app. The governor vetoed the measure today, saying it would have prevented local governments from adopting rules to fit their communities. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our guest, Dr. John Wright. Well, we've talked about Shelley versus Kramer. I want to talk within the context of that, Dr. Wright, about Pruitt-Igoe, because Pruitt-Igoe is another one of those places that is well-remembered. That, of course, opened up in the 50s, just a few years after the Shelley versus Kramer decision.
It was supposed to be ideal housing.
Yeah.
Ideal housing with elevators that stopped on every other floor, no services. It was a city of thousands of people. Igoe was for white residents. Pruitt was for black residents. Frankie Freeman took the... Attorney Frankie Freeman took the housing authority to court because she had long waiting lists for African Americans in open vacant places for white residents to force the Singles Housing Authority to integrate the housing. But when it failed, after a period of time, it was a miserable failure. High crime rate, no services, and it was abandoned. And that forced individuals to be scattered throughout the county, and many of them went to North County.
And, of course, we can't continue the conversation very long without mentioning the Del Mar Divide, because everything north of Del Mar pretty much was African American, and pretty much to the south, Caucasian.
Yeah, it wasn't always that way.
No, I know.
You know, when housing in Mill Creek was torn down, many African Americans were shunted towards the western part of the city, and many of those large homes were made into rooming houses. I remember Hempstead School at one time, because of the overcrowd, had 13 busloads of kids who were transferred to South St. Louis to go to school. And that was intact busing because that area was so overcrowded.
I thought you were going to continue.
No. It was just because we were shunted to the northern part of the city and the western part of the city in Northern County.
But getting back to the public housing situation, as I recall, in the subsequent years, there were a lot of rent strikes. I remember Reverend Buck Jones, Bertha Gilkey, and people like that were very, very active in that part of the
story. Had lead paint. Ivory Perry was against that. He's held up traffic. You had no controls over the housing, I think. Bertha Gilkey wanted tenant management. Because everything was going wild in these units, out of control. So if they felt the tenants could come in, they could put some controls over things. It was just kind of abandoned.
One of the things that I recall having heard about places like Pruitt-Igoe, for instance, is one of the conditions of living there was that there had to be a man in the house.
Yeah, they divided up families. The thing I found interesting with public housing, if you were successful, you had to leave, which meant you never had a stable base. And I could see raising the rent moderately, so you have people who care. It's almost saying if you care, you got to go. And so as a result of that, the stable base wasn't allowed to stay. The same thing happened with Laclede Town. When they managed Laclede Town, which was another integrated community, and said you have to keep strict control over the income and the numbers, and they forced people who got, they made the rent so high they had to move, and as a result it collapsed. Yeah. And I think we have to remember the government was the cause of a lot of the things at Pruitt Igoe because of rules and regulations.
And all of this conspired to create a very restive community, didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, if you, I've got pictures of dogs and the police outside of Pruitt Igoe coming in. I used to work the juvenile court, and there were battles going on between the police. Kids would tell me the battles went on between the police and the neighbors. Kids said they used to get pleasure because they were so much antagonism, dropping bricks on the police heads out the window. I mean, it was like a jungle that was created because of rules and regulations and things like that. Wow.
I've had more than one police officer tell me that they would drive through Pruitt Igoe and come out and find a bullet hole in the roof of their car. People were not happy to see the
cops. Well, they were used to it. I've heard when there were fights, the sirens went on three blocks away, all of them at one time, so the crowd would kind of disperse by the time they got there.
And again, with this kind of powder keg, this boiling water, if you will, this roiling attitude, I'm surprised, in a sense, that St. Louis didn't explode like the other cities.
Well, many times the leaders were given jobs.
Okay, let me stop you right there, because this is a key and this is where I want to go. Perhaps the most famous protest demonstration in St. Louis was held here in 1963 at the Jefferson Bank. Black political, religious, and activist leaders protested the lack of jobs for blacks in the banks and elsewhere. One of the key players in the demonstrations was a city alderman, later Congressman William Clay. I talked with him and his son, Congressman Lacey Clay, about the Elder Clay's book, The Jefferson Bank Confrontation, The Struggle for Civil Rights in St. Louis. The former congressman talked about employment discrimination here at the time.
Well, it was what I referred to as economic genocide. Black people were excluded from every major industry in this town. You couldn't be a salesperson in the four downtown department stores. You couldn't drive the buses from the breweries, from the dairies, from the bread companies. You couldn't work in the construction unions. You couldn't sell automobiles. All of this in 1963. So you have to understand where we were. You had two publishing companies of religious periodicals. They had two blacks working for them out of 900 employees, and they were both menial positions. This was true across the board, including city employees and state employees and federal employees in this whole region. So it was total exclusion of black people in the employment field. Bob Curtis, who was chairman of CORE, wrote a letter to a number of institutions suggesting to them in very strong terms that you hire X number of blacks within a certain period of time. The attorney for the Jefferson Bank wrote back and said that this was against the law, that we were insisting that they show preferential treatment to blacks over qualified whites in employment, and that he didn't know four blacks in the whole city who were qualified to work in that bank. So theoretically, they picked themselves. It was a small organization. We couldn't go after everybody that was discriminating, but we decided that they wanted it.
And they got it. Seven at the time, Lacey Clay remembers his father being among a handful of demonstrators arrested.
I remember that fateful day in August of 1963 when demonstrators were first proceeded around the bank demonstrating, and then we violated the court order and went inside and sat and did a sit-in in the lobby. So I remember that, and then I remember that evening the police coming around the house and eventually my father turning himself in. And then for several years after that, us being involved in the court proceedings and going down to the jailhouse to visit him, first in the old city jail, and then to the newer workhouse at that time.
The elder Clay remembers as well.
Well, it was really a holding place to take convicted individuals who were convicted of murder and rape and all of the other bank robbery, all of the other crimes to jail. It was just while they were either awaiting trial or had been convicted and were waiting to be transferred. So it wasn't a nice place. It was a very, very dangerous place.
Those jailed had formidable allies like Margaret Bush Wilson, whose civil rights work went back to the post-war era and helped produce a Supreme Court ruling against restrictive covenants in the Shelley versus Kramer case. The demonstrations drove the white establishment closer together, but the black community at large was mad as hell and not going to take it anymore.
Oh, I think that was the general attitude of the community. And we're thankful that we had people who give leadership like the ones you mentioned. Margaret Bush Wilson was there as our attorney, along with 17 other black lawyers who pro bono provided us with the legal representation. You had Norman Say and 18 others, along with myself, who challenged the system, and we were sentenced to some pretty heavy terms, up to a year in jail for contempt of court. The most strenuous and the longest sentences in the history of this state for contempt. And we were fined thousands of dollars, but the community rallied. More than 500 people got arrested at that bank in protest to what was going on. And it wasn't just the bank that we were protesting. We were protesting employment across the board. The business community decided that we didn't want the same thing that happened to our city that was happening around the country when there were riots and burnings and all. And they decided that they were going to accommodate what was only fair. The downtown stores started hiring salespeople. The automobile companies hired salespeople. The banks hired 800 black people in positions they had never been in before. And this was happening across the board.
Things began to change. According to the Clays, the Jefferson Bank confrontation, though it was almost 4 years before all the litigation was over, may have spared the city more violent problems down the road. The Clays believe that the demonstration and the result released a pressure valve that was bursting in other places. They say confrontation in 1963 prevented conflagration in later years. Lacey Clay.
I remember the weekend that Dr. King was shot in April of 1968. And instead of St. Louis burning to the ground, the St. Louis leadership, including my dad, organized a peaceful demonstration from the Arch Grounds to Forest Park, I believe. And that kind of quelled any of the hostilities that may have been bubbling under the surface in the community. I just think St. Louis has approached it in a different way, like the Jefferson Bank demonstration. Now, whether it would have been better for St. Louis to burn down, I'm not sure. Having lived through it, I think it was better that it didn't burn.
The Jefferson Bank demonstration did for this town what the other cities that did burn, a lot of them, were still demanding. We got the jobs and we got the positions.
Former Congressman William Clay and his son Lacey Clay, the current congressman from the 1st District of St. Louis, talking about the Jefferson Bank demonstration. You can hear more of this kind of history on our St. Louis in Black and White project, which you can find on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Back to Dr. John Wright. I know you're going to buy into their conclusion that the Jefferson Bank demonstration kept the lid on because of that all-important factor, jobs.
It did. We've got a warning now. Another warning that we've got some things we have to do. The Jefferson Bank provided jobs. Percy Green followed with Climbing of the Arch.
Right.
To draw national attention. We had national attention brought to St. Louis because of lack of employment. And we created situations where if we didn't do certain things in this town, it cost money. And money always bring about changes.
Money talks.
Money talks. And I think the threat that the city was faced with, if we don't make changes in the business community and the way we do things, it's going to cost the city money. And I think the changes came about because of that. I think we're on the brink of that same thing now. If we don't make some changes, we'll have more Fergusons.
I want to pick up on that point when we come back. I have to take another break. But you mentioned Percy Green. He's been on this program a number of times. And again, in this project that we have on our website, St. Louis History in Black and White, we have a wonderful segment with Percy Green and Frankie Freeman talking about civil disobedience versus the rule of law. It is a wonderful conversation. You know, they're both right, of course. They do it their own way and accomplish their significant results in their own way. We'll be back in just a moment to continue our conversation with Dr. John Wright, retired educator and author historian. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back. And we'll continue our discussion with Dr. John Wright. He's a retired educator and an author and a historian and a man who's been around long enough to know firsthand about a lot of the things we're talking about today, and that is putting the situation in Ferguson in some sort of historical context. You mentioned the fact that the NAACP early on did not get involved with the Shelley versus Kramer case.
When they went to the Supreme Court,
was just mentioned by the Clays that Core was very, very active. What was the difference in the 60s between Core and the role of Core in the NAACP?
Well, you had a group like with Percy and some of the others believe gentlemen discussions were not always as productive as civil disobedience. And they believed that if you make things uncomfortable, where money was involved, changes came about. And if you notice, we had a group of African Americans who were meeting with Civic Progress not too long ago. And they gave up after years. They said all they did was sit down and have breakfast and discuss things. There was no movement of significance. And when you have tax put down, the Veil of Prophet parade, surf spilled in the lobby of some of the places where your policies are sticky, where you have telephone lines tied up, those are things when they clam their arch and drew attention to problems, then we're forced to work out some way to bring conclusion to end those discriminations.
Yeah, you mentioned the Veiled Prophet. That brings us back to Percy Green again and the famous incident at the Veiled Prophet Ball, I guess it was.
Yeah, Gina.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Gina Scott, who was white, swung down on a rope and unveiled the Veil of Prophet.
Right.
The queen, the veiled prophet, was
sure
at the queen ceremony. But it was a matter of bringing attention to the fact that there was city money being used, we were funding this organization, and it was exclusive and didn't include the
African-American. There was outrage in the white community, a large portions of it, after this particular act, which was considered almost a sacrilege.
Oh, yes. I mean, we blew up. The white community really got very disturbed by it. I was on leave with the Citizen Education Task Force, and Gina Scott was one of the employees of the task force. And Jane Shafley, who was the sister of Tom K. Smith, who had his veil pulled off, that caused quite a disruption with our organization because of that, because Danforth Foundation was funding the organization.
One thing that I think we should probably spend a moment talking about is the fact that this was not solely an African-American effort. I mean, you mentioned the young lady who helped in the VP Fair. We know that the Oldhams, for instance, Charles Oldham was very actively involved in all of this. There was the Josephine Fitzgerald that was mentioned as part of this deception in the Shelley versus Kramer case. There was a lot of white assistance to the cause in those days. Well, maybe I should temper that and say not necessarily a lot, but a significant amount.
Throughout the history of St. Louis, whites have played a prominent role to help African Americans achieve their rights in this community. Where you have those who oppose them, there have been a number who have seen. Take Elijah P. Lovejoy, when the McIntosh was burned alive downtown. He was driven out of town for printing up and talking about that.
Famous abolitionist,
one who gave his life for freedom of the press. Archer Alexander was hidden by William Elliott, the Chancellor of Washington University, when he ran away from slavery and helped the Union Army. And so we just have stories we can go Roswell Fields was the attorney for the Dred Scott decision. So we can go on throughout history where you have had some whites who have stepped up to the plate to make sure things were made right.
And yet significantly not enough have, because we still are where we are.
What I'd like to see happen after this thing with the Ferguson situation, we have ministers, African-American ministers, community leaders stepped up and said the looters don't represent us. We need the white community to say the bigots in the community don't represent us. And I think working together at that point, we can make a difference.
Right. Now, we're listening to Dr. John Wright, and I want to bring members of the audience into the conversation in the time we have left. 382-8255 is our number. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. But, John, you know, one of the things that I've noticed in the time that I've been here is the fact that when there have been these flashpoints, and none quite as serious as the one in Ferguson, there's always a talk for having, quote, a conversation. And let's sit down and talk and resolve these issues that confront the community. But then once the event is over, the talk stops. I mean, why is that there has never been any real momentum? And what would make you think, for instance, that we'll have some momentum now when this goes away?
It all depends on how serious we are.
Yeah.
If we really want change, change will take place. If we aren't serious, we'll have another Ferguson. And the threat of another Ferguson may move us forward. And hopefully we can see the writing on the wall.
Well, I just wonder. I mean, it's happened before. You know, organizations in town have done reports on the segregation in this community, the racial polarization, which is well known and well documented. And every time one of these reports comes out, it hits the papers or it hits the radio stations, television stations for a day or two, and then it gets thrown in a drawer.
Well, I really don't think the white community feels it impacts them that much. And I think we all pay a price. For example, the white flight is caused by realtors who want to make money on them. And so they make the money, and so it's in their, to their advantage to have fear for whites. You have companies who could care less about blacks or whites. The name of the game is how much money we can make. And as a result of, we have to educate the community how we're all paying a price for the situation we're living in. And when we know it impacts all of us, directly or indirectly, we begin to make change. And there are some who are oblivious to the fact that they're being taken advantage of, and they're hurt, being hurt just as much as the African-American community.
I was with some folks last night, and their concern was that the reputation that St. Louis gets as a result of all the headlines and all the video and all the rest of it with regard to Ferguson, that how many people and businesses are out there who might be entertaining the notion of coming to St. Louis to set up shop, to live here, to start a business and what have you, who are going to be totally turned off and say, whoa, no, I'm not going there. That's a dangerous place.
Well, there's a feeling that the burning of Francis McIntosh in the 1800s and then the hanging of the four African-Americans, cutting their heads off, putting them in the window, had a dampening effect on the city's growth at that time. And I think there are landmark decisions that are made in events that can have an impact on how the city will grow. And those are just things that people haven't, you know, not too long ago there was an article in the paper where the French were telling their citizens, if you travel to St. Louis, it's a dangerous place. There are certain places you shouldn't go. So if we don't handle these things, whether we want it to be the perception of others, it's there. And so we have to be aware of that.
And have to change it. For those who don't know, tell, if you could, briefly, the McIntosh story.
McIntosh was a free African-American who was on a boat. He happened to be walking down the street. The sheriff was arresting someone. He asked what was going on. They said, well, they're going to take him to jail. He pulled out his knife and cut the sheriff, and he died. He was taken to jail. He was taken out of the jail, drugged, and tied up to a tree and set on fire. And people watched him burn. He was asked to be shot. Well, it was a barbaric act. Elijah P. Lovejoy, who was an abolitionist newspaper reporter, wrote about the story in graphic details. He was chased out of St. Louis over to Alton. He continued to write about slavery in St. Louis. And so it kind of put the spotlight on St. Louis. Even Lincoln, when he gave one of his addresses, talked about the situation. But it made national news.
And you say there were beheadings.
There were beheadings of four African-Americans who were hung on Duncan Island. And once they were hung, their heads were cut off and put in a drugstore window, Myers drugstore window, downtown to discourage other unrest and insurrections.
Incredible stories. I mean, it's just hard to imagine.
But they have an impact on the city's image.
Of course.
And this will have an impact. Do you want to come to a place? Certain neighborhoods, when they have do you want to move there? And so people don't know about it. It's St. Louis.
That's right.
You know, we've got 90-some municipalities, but in the world we live in is St. Louis. Whether we want it to be, I live in Chesterfield. To the rest of the world, you live in St. Louis. And so what happens in St. Louis does impact you.
What you mentioned Lovejoy, a newspaper publisher, obviously, the day's media, that was pretty much it. What about the media's role in all of this, as you've observed the last couple of weeks?
It's been because of social media. We can't get away from it.
Yeah.
I think some of the things that would have happened had we not had social media would have been ignored. And I think the fact that social media was there with cameras on their phones and going back and forth, we've had to focus on it. Some people feel that this would have been a quiet incident had it not been for social media.
But I wonder if that's what we want. I mean, this might not have been reported in some cases, or things might not be reported if it weren't for these people taking those pictures and sending their tweets and putting it on Facebook.
I'm glad we have it.
Yeah,
some of it's kind of off, wrong information in some cases, but for the most part, it's been one of those things to keep it in front of us. I was surprised how you have reporters from all over the country here. Al Jazeera even had reporters reporting on the Ferguson incident. The Palestinians sent emails telling the people how to fight the tear gas, how to put milk on. They were saying, we're brothers and sisters in this struggle, and here are some things that can help you. So it's an international incident.
Remarkable the way the news traveled. Talk about a global village. Yeah. There's no question about that. We have just about 2 minutes left, John Wright. Who has to sit down? Who has to sit down and get this dialogue going in a meaningful way?
We all have to. You know,
That's easy to say.
It may start with my own family. You know, when we were talking about racism at times, I said, the hardest discussion, you may be talking with mother or father. And if mother's a bigot and father's a bigot, if you work on them, your impact may impact hundreds of others. But we all have to realize it's not a group. We're all waiting for a savior, someone to come along. But it's up to each individual, each of us as individuals, to carry the torch. And it starts right in our own homes, in our church. You know, when we were doing the 60s, we were talking about going fixing up neighborhoods and homes, and the slumlord was right in the church. We need to get the slumlord to fix up his own homes, and that gives us time to do some other things. But it's up to us as individuals to assume responsibility and go out into the world to help save it.
You have children?
I have three.
What did you tell those kids growing up? And I've only got about 45 seconds.
I tell them we all have responsibility, and to respect themselves. They need an education. And once they educate themselves, then some of this, all this other stuff that they hear, they know how to decipher it and make judgments, sound judgments, help build for a better world.
Education is not a priority amongst a lot of the kids today.
I don't think they're going to live long enough. If you think you're going to die early, there's no need for an education. We got to help give these children hope that there's a world out there beyond the day.
That's one thing the white community does not understand, what it's like to live like that, with a kid growing up thinking he's not going to live past the age of 22 or 23.
Right.
Yeah. Dr. John Wright, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for helping put this whole thing in some sort of historical context.
Thank you.
Pleasure seeing
pleasure
you once again. Here. And tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with NPR's Michelle Martin. She is the former host of Tell Me More, and we'll continue this dialogue about Ferguson and other things that are race-related. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.